This is Greg Felton. I make my living teaching English and American history, but my real passion is writing history and writing books. I used to be a journalist back when it was seemed to be respectable, but since the World Trade Center was effectively nuked, I realized that journalism was a waste of my talents. You couldn't be an honest journalist and make a living. I live in southwestern BC, which is undergoing its first real cold snap. And
that's Vancouver.
Yeah, that's right. The greater Vancouver area. There's a number of different cities that form the GVRD, the district.
One of the little sidelines, and you may know something about this living in Vancouver, is there's been quite a hotly contested battles over the last decade or so over who actually owns the land. The British apparently took it over for on behalf of God many years ago from the Native Americans. So is anything going on over there to do with the Native Americans populations trying to get the land back from the British? I mean, the British have gone long gone.
Well, the British are no longer relevant. Back in 1949, I believe, King George VI formally severed any connection between the British Crown and Canada. So if anybody who tries to appeal to Great Britain doesn't know his history. So there's no point in even discussing. The natives were hard done by. Let's not kid ourselves. But it's a little bit too late in the day to turn the clock back and say, okay, we were wrong, we're going to give you your land back. It's not going to happen. So really, Canada, if it is going to be a country, it has to be able to defend itself, because this country is more than the sum total of its history with the native peoples. Canada has done great things in its history, but we have to stop wallowing in the past and focusing solely upon the negative aspects of Canadian history. There is debate.
Yeah, we have a problem in the UK quite often. If someone with a North American accent, you meet them in a bar or a coffee shop or whatever, people kind of assume that they're from the United States, Greg.
Yeah, that's a common assumption. It's like assuming all Scots are English. You know, it's not exactly a fair, assumption. But if you listen to the way people speak, Canadians do speak a little bit differently. I mean, Americans have a lot of twangs and drawls. They have a lot more variety in their speech. I'm used to people mistaking me for an American. I guess I'm a North American, but I don't get mad. I just say, no, I'm not. I'm not American. I'm Canadian.
I mean, is there any real difference between Canada and the United States? Trudeau and Biden seem to be sort of joined at the hip, really.
Well, they're joined. I don't know whether it's the hip, but Trudeau is essentially a cowardly little schmuck. He came into politics with no real qualifications for governance. He spent his entire professional career teaching drama in the public school system in British Columbia. And he only had his youthful good looks and daddy's surname, and that's what made him a political figure. And Trudeau really is incompetent. He is incompetent in so many ways. And I've written voluminously on him in my previous writings. So Trudeau doesn't have, he's a bit like Biden in that he's a stooge of the Israel lobby.
We had a recent, before Christmas, I think it was November time, unbelievable episode in the Canadian Parliament with a standing ovation being given for a former SS non-commissioned officer in the actual Parliament, which I found quite extraordinary. And then a great apology, and the Speaker of Parliament was, resigned.
Yeah, the reason for that is, you see, Canada, like a lot of countries, is being stampeded into supporting Ukraine against Russia. Now, of course, Russia really is not the villain in this piece. The villain is the United States and NATO, which provoked this war going back Oh, I would say to the 1990s, really, but in earnest since 2014. It's my guess, and I don't know this for certain, but I doubt very much whether this Ukrainian was vetted. You would say, oh, here's a guy, he's a World War II vet, he's Ukrainian. Hey, bring him into Parliament, we'll celebrate him, we'll fet him, and we'll make a big deal out of how wonderful he is to show how much we support the United States' contrived violence against Russia. Well, you see, nobody did homework on this. And so once it was revealed that he was a Nazi and non-commissioned officer, everybody hurried to say, I'm so sorry, we didn't know. But you see, the reflex to support the Americans is so pervasive that nobody bothers to think. It was such an automatic conditioned reflex. Oh, he's Ukrainian. Well, that's what happened. And the speaker was so incredibly stupid. And he should have known better because the Ukrainian came from his riding. So he didn't even know the guy he was going to celebrate, which is, and it just shows you the degree to which thinking has become such a passe preoccupation in Canadian government.
Well, yeah, it's not just in the government. It seems to me that there is a kind of groupthink developing, which, you know, no one's supposed to be thinking outside it. But listen, we spoke beginning of 2022, I think it was, about the Ukraine, when just after Ukraine had finished, we're coming up for 2 years now, the invasion of Ukraine by the special military operation by the Russians. About you mentioned, which I found it absolutely, I was totally convinced, actually, that you believe that there was a very strong connection between the decades of lack of peace, war in the Middle East, the division between Arabs and Israelis, mm-hmm. and what was going on in Ukraine. So can you just mm-hmm. refresh us as to why we make the connection between the two conflicts?
Well, historically, Russia has, the Soviet Union had been a supporter of the Arab states in the Middle East. Because the Soviet Union and the Americans were on opposite sides of the ideological divide, and Israel seemed to be an ally, really it was the master of the United States, it was logical that the Russians would pick up the Arab side. And besides, the Arabs, the Russians really supported, you know, the Arab movement. They found it a useful way to expand their influence, and there was no animosity between Russians and the Arabs. But you see, Ukraine is, so you have to go back to the early 90s when the American governments promised on a stack of Bibles, metaphorically speaking, not to expand NATO westward after the Warsaw Pact was dissolved. And from that, President Boris Yeltsin and his successor, Mikhail Gorbachev, believed that the United States was going to de-escalate tensions and that NATO would be similarly wound up. Well, that didn't happen. And despite repeated promises, more than a dozen countries have been added to NATO, all east of where the 1991 division was. So Russia had been getting screwed over royally since the end of the Warsaw Pact. And at some point, the Russians said, enough is enough. And that's why they attacked almost 2 years ago, February. Now, for the Russians, being supporters of Syria and Iran, Lebanon and so forth, this got up the nose of the Israelis, who see as their God-given right to commit mass murder wherever they want and take over as much land as they think God has willed to them. So the attempt to provoke Ukraine into being a cat's paw to start a war with Russia, both had economic reasons because, well, America is a colossal economic machine that gobbles up resources hand over fist. It wants to expand its influence. And Ukraine is such a corrupt, backward backwater that it can only benefit from joining the European Union. So the United States sought to bring Ukraine into NATO, despite promises that it would never do so, in order to provoke aggression against Russia, both because Russia poses a legitimate economic rivalry to the United States, and perhaps the ruble could become, say, an international currency, trade currency, much to replace the U.S. dollar. But also the Israelis, which really run the United States. I mean, nothing is done without the lobby's approval. They would love to see Russia broken, because that would take away some of the great impediments to their expansion in the Middle East. Remember that the Americans were bombing Syria and creating ISIS, or Daesh in Arabic. And it was the Russians that were getting in the way. They weren't allowing the United States and Israel to prosecute its destruction of Syria as a stepping stone to attacking Iran. Moreover, Russia has strong relations with Iran. So for Israel, provoking war on Russia has only an upside. It's a great thing for Israelis because, hey, Americans are going to waste their lives. They're going to do all the dirty work, and Israel will be the beneficiary. It's the standard business model of organized crime. I mean, let's face it, Israel is the physical manifestation of the kosher Nostra. And the United States is the biggest client state and has been for ages. I mean, back, I forget what year it was now, but it wasn't that long ago where Netanyahu likened the United States to a golden calf to be almost bled white for the service of Israel. I have to get the quotation right. It's a really good one. I just happened to catch it recently. But even the Israelis admit the U.S. is to be exploited. I mean, it's to be pillaged, is to be bled white. And Americans haven't got the balls to stand up to them, which is why we're in this mess now in Ukraine and in Palestine, and even provoking aggression against China. I mean, China is also a major rival to the United States. I mean, the Chinese economy is second to the American economy. And eventually it's going to overtake it. And America doesn't like to play second fiddle to anyone. So right now, the Ukraine war should be seen as a surrogate proxy war of the United States, both in the service of Israel to eliminate a major supporter of Arab and Iranian states, and as a way to challenge Russia economically. Because if you notice what happened to Russia, no sooner had the war started than we had massive ostracism. Russia was cut out of the SWIFT banking payment transfer system. It has been expelled from I don't know how many organizations. Russia was made a pariah state because that's what the United States wanted. And that's the role Ukraine serves. I mean, Americans are going to fight this war down to the last Ukrainian. And Ukrainians are just, I don't know how stupid they are, because they are not going to benefit from this war. They're being killed. They're expendable, really. They're expendable cannon fodder. They take out to fight Russia for the United States and for Israel. And that's the way I see it.
You thought that the myth of Israel as a democratic, civilized state has been thoroughly exploded. Well, we've now got this International Court of Justice case by the South Africans accusing Israel of genocide. Now, the official figures are around 23,000 Palestinians have been killed in the annihilation of Gaza. Actually, the figures could be a lot more because the internet has been very intermittent in Gaza, so it's very difficult for the figures to be compiled. You've got one of the main organizations that's compiling those figures, Hamas. The Israelis are doing everything they can to destroy it completely. So, and also keeping the journalists out of Gaza, killing many of the journalists that were in Gaza and keeping any more that might want to go. So there's all sorts of problems with these figures. Some estimates up to 60, 70,000 civilians could have been killed there so far. So, I mean, what do you mean by this colossal myth then?
Well, first of all, let me, I've got a figure here from today about the number of dead in Palestine, 30,034, of whom 11,833 are children. So that's the death toll. If that isn't a genocide, then the word has no meaning. What I said about Israel is that, I mean, Israel, it has no substance. It is an illegal entity. It has no legitimate existence. It was not created by the partition plan. The United Nations did not create Israel because the partition plan was never ratified. Israel is not democratic. It is. It has more in common with Nazi Germany than any democratic state that you care to name. And this has been admitted by David Ben-Gurion, frankly.
Well, just hang on, because you've got, you know, surrounded by these Arab caliphates, effectively monarchies, and there are elections. And many would argue that actually it's the Israeli public that get the government that they want, because something like 75% of the Israeli public are vehemently anti-Arab.
Well, that really hardly matters, though. I mean, government of Israel is not based on any democratic standard by which everybody who lives there is equal under the law. I mean, Arabs, even Arabs in Israel, are second-class citizens, treated probably worse than the Jews were under Adolf Hitler. So let's not kid ourselves that Israel is a garrison state of Europeans, Jewish Europeans, who claim a land based upon some biblical superstition. And to do that, they have to dispossess the native inhabitants. Now, this has been going on for ages, and they've been getting away with it because they hide behind the rhetoric of the Holocaust. Because if you criticize Israel, you criticize the Holocaust, if you criticize the Holocaust, you criticize Jews, and you're anti-Semitic, a term that only came into the language in 1873 and has no substance. A German bigot by the name of Wilhelm Marr invented it to attack Jews for reasons other than religion. I mean, Semitism has no meaning. The word Semitic refers to languages, of which Arabic, Hebrew, Aramaic, and others were Semitic languages. At any rate, the notion that Israel is a democracy is simply an assertion that has never been defended. Yes, they have elections, but so what? If you want to know, the only election in the Middle East in the last, I guess, 30 years that was the most honest was the election in Palestine that elected Hamas to be the government of the Palestinian people. But today, it is not permitted to use the word Palestine, because that would be terribly embarrassing to the Zionist occupiers. Here in Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the public broadcaster, which ostensibly is a voice of Canada and has some cachet, being respectable, gave its reporters that order: you are not allowed to use Palestine. You do, you lose your job. Because it's patent rubbish to say that Israel is fighting Hamas. You might as well say that China is fighting the Democrats, not the United States. Hamas is just a political party. Yes, it's got a military wing, but so what? So does Israel. So much of the rhetoric about Israel is patent bullshit. There is nothing defensible about Israel. It has never been a democracy. In fact, if you go back to the documents around the, in the 1930s, the Zionists and the Nazis were bosom buddies. I mean, there was signature of common interest between the Nazis and the Zionists through the efforts of two people, Ginsburg and Bar Gilad. There are plenty of examples of how the Zionist Jews in Germany helped the Nazis stay afloat. And if you look at the behavior of the Nazis and Israel, there's precious little difference. They're both.
Look, can you just explain, Greg, if it's so, what were these relations between the Nazi, Adolf Hitler's and his crew, and these Zionists? What actual relations did they have? It's not really good enough just to say they were bosom buddies.
Well, the fact of the matter is, the Jews of Europe were trying to flee the country to avoid persecution, which you can understand. That's not difficult to figure out. But you see, the Nazis didn't care what happened to them. Whether they lived or died, doesn't matter. They wanted the Nazis wanted the Jews out of Europe. That was it, period. The Zionists said, well, no, that's not good enough. I mean, that's anti-Zionist. We don't want Jews fleeing. David Ben-Gurion said this quite openly in 1938. He said that, let me just find this here. I've got the book here. he said this in 1938. The saving of Jewish lives from Hitler is considered here as a potential threat to Zionism unless they are brought to Palestine. When Zionism had to choose between the Jewish people and the Jewish state, it unhesitatingly preferred the latter. So the Zionists were the only Jewish type that had any time for the Nazis. The liberal Jews, the Hasidic Jews, everybody, every other conservative Jews, they were all persecuted. They were all Yiddishers. Yiddish Jews, about 98% of them, they were persecuted. But the 2% of the German Jews who were Zionists formed common cause with the Nazis through what was called the transfer agreements. It was kind of like a back channel trading arrangement whereby the Zionists would help Adolf Hitler's economy survive the worldwide boycott of German goods. I mean, there are ships that moved into Boston and New York Harbor, longshoremen wouldn't touch because they opposed the persecution of the Jews of Europe. And there was a very effective boycott led by the Jewish war veterans of World War I. It was damn effective. But you see, because of the Zionists, Zionists kept Hitler from collapsing. Because without Zionist influence, without Zionists helping to mediate trade between the world and Nazi Germany, Hitler's Reich would probably have collapsed within 3 years.
Well, look, you seem to be implying, Greg, that you've got, you've got a large millions of Jews in Europe. Some of them did pick up the Zionist cause, and others didn't. And it's almost as if you're saying, well, those that did start to believe in this idea of a return to Palestine, they were transferred. I think you said the transfer agreement, some of them were transferred, many of them were moved over there, but the ones that didn't believe in Zionism were exterminated.
That's correct. Well, I wouldn't say exterminated. There were no, let's get our language careful here. There were no death camps, there were no gas chambers. That's the one thing about history that has to be made clear. That the gas chambers, so-called, were added after the war by the Soviet Union for propaganda purposes. And that is the testimony of Franciszek Piper, who is the superintendent, or was the superintendent, of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Shrine. So the Jews that weren't Zionist, who did not want to go to Palestine, were blocked from leaving by the Zionists and had no one to help them. So I don't know how many died. I mean, originally the Red Cross estimated the deaths from about something like 280,000, although I don't know how accurate that figure is. Certainly it wasn't 6 million. That much is certain. But any Jew that did not want to go to Palestine would get no support from the Zionists. They're the ones keeping the Nazis alive. And if you look at the parallels between the Nazis and the Zionists, I mean, it's scary how similar they are. They're both fruit of the same poisonous tree of fascism. I mean, the Nazis did lose the war, but fascism found a new home in Palestine. Well, I mean,
can you draw some parallels then?
What do you mean parallels?
Between Zionism and the Nazis.
Well, certainly. Well, both of them are chauvinistic. They have scapegoats. They are militaristic. They are hyper-nationalistic. I don't think it's that difficult to examine how similar the Nazis and the Zionists were. But I didn't want to get too wrapped up in the history of Zionism. I was looking more or less to show that Israel today has essentially admitted to the world, we are not a democracy. We are a genocidal neo-fascist state that hides behind the skirt of Judaism to justify its existence. And guess what? You can't do anything about it. We are tired of putting up with these Palestinians, so we're going to kill them all. We're going to destroy their homes. We're going to commit all sorts of atrocities, and we're going to expect you to concoct sophistries to justify our actions. The only thing that's kind of weird here, for me anyway, is that I think the Zionists in Israel seriously miscalculated. I don't think they realized just how much the world was going to object to their massacre of Arabs. I mean, for crying out loud, 30,000 people butchered since October the 7th. I mean, how many people know that most of the Jews that were killed on that day were killed by the Israeli military? The Israeli military was given the order to kill anyone leaving or entering Palestine. I mean, there were Jews living in their homes that were killed by rockets fired from Israeli aircraft. But we don't talk about that. We only blither on about Hamas as if Hamas had anything to do with it. Hamas doesn't have anything to do with this.
Okay, so what do you make of the other crimes which are being examined in The Hague now at the United Nations Court, not the silly little International Criminal Court, which is just a kind of a little annex off the side of the NATO headquarters, but the ICJ is a far more serious deal. And one of the things that's being addressed there, for example, is this deprivation of food and water.
That's right. And there was a British MP got up and he noted that Israel had turned the water back on. Now, that means originally Israel had turned it off, which is a crime against humanity. Israel, because it's so brazen and it thinks it has so much control over the world and how the world behaves, that it can effectively admit that it's a war criminal state and get away with it. It can indulge the carelessness of its own rhetoric. I mean, the Israelis are denying Palestinians electricity, water, food, shelter, everything that is considered a basic necessity for life. I mean, it's appalling. And yet nobody is doing anything about it. We try to ignore it. I mean, can you see just how much the world is bending over backwards not to condemn Israel? There are people making excuses for, oh, it's Hamas. Hamas did this, blah, blah, blah. Well, who cares? Israel is on record as engaging in disproportionate attacks against anyone who should attack Israel. This was admitted back in the last violence in Lebanon. An artillery colonel said what we did was monstrosity. It was monstrous. I mean, you had mass killing just because the Palestinians are in Lebanon. I mean, there was no need for anything that Israel did. Nothing whatsoever. It has no regard for human life. It has no regard for the law. And right now it's so brazen. The only question is how long this is going to go on for before the world actually says, okay, Israel, enough is enough. We're going to send in our army. We're going to take you out. We're going to blow the living shit out of you, which should have happened decades ago. How long is this going to go on for? I mean, the public around the world is apoplectic at the genocide being committed in Palestine. But no one is doing anything. We're just watching it and saying, tut, tut, isn't this awful?
Well, no, that's not quite the case, because the Yemenis have been denying the Red Sea to Western trade. This is sending the big corporations. Well, I mean, Lloyd's of London are looking at this very closely, and other big insurance companies. And these ships are now coming from India, China, etc. to Europe, are having to make an extra 6,000-mile trip, which is costing a few bob.
Yeah, well, that doesn't really make much difference. It's not exactly a war crime, is it? I mean, who cares? The Yemenis are doing what they can to make life difficult for Western governments and Western
economies.
Well,
the British and the American navies, the Royal Navy and the U.S. Navy do care. They've got their ships and submarines sitting around in the Red Sea. I don't know how they managed to get in there, but they did somehow. And they are saying that it's extremely important that this shipping lane is kept open, and they're prepared to go to war with Yemen to make sure it does.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. But, I mean, this is hardly equivalent to the genocide in Palestine. This is just an economic inconvenience. Yes, it may cost the Western governments a little bit more money to get from point A to point B on the open, the high seas. But so what? I don't see why that's really that important. What would be important is if the Brits and the Americans allowed their arrogance to get the better of them and decided to start a shooting war, a real shooting war with the Yemenis. I mean, does the United States need another front to fight on? It's already provoked war in Ukraine. It's provoked or helped to provoke war in Palestine. It's saber-rattling with the Chinese. It's trying to ostracize the Russians. Does it need to go fight the Yemenis? I mean, one of my favorite expressions is, if the Americans ain't killing, they ain't happy.
Well, there's a bit more American killing going on of Yemenis now, as of this week. Reuters and the Press Association reporting that the British warships and American warships have now been firing into Yemen to make sure that the Saudis have reined back their war in Yemen, and it looks as if the Saudis are shrugging their shoulders and walking off the other way and saying, if you want to take the Houthis on, it's now down to you guys. But more importantly, all this, you've been studying this for decades, Greg. We've got these three countries all connected to Britain, both Israel and the United States, if you go back far enough, are the spawn of London. And I want you to give us your take on whereabouts power lies. Is this just three different, we can forget, for example, the French having called for a ceasefire, which the British won't do. Which of these three countries is really, and how does that power dynamic work between Britain, United States and Israel?
Well, let's look at Britain first. Britain was king of the world in the 18th century, ruled Britannia, and it colonized what is now the Eastern North America and created the United States. So the United States is a product of Britain. The United Britain had the mandate of Palestine after World War I, and the British government had a lot of files, Judeo-files, like Josiah Wedgwood and David Balfour and a few other people. And they supported the creation of Israel. So you might think initially it was Great Britain who created the Americans, which is the power source. But no, Britain after World War I was a shadow of its former self. It had to sell off the empire, allow independence movements, because Well, they couldn't afford to keep places like India or Kenya or Egypt and so forth. The United States became the great imperial power of the world, especially in the 1900s under Theodore Roosevelt. It was great for domestic policy, but not so great for foreign policy. Then we had this problem with Israel, which was essentially a misbegotten notion. I mean, it was the United States, 26 senators of the United States, blackmailed resistant countries in the General Assembly to pass the partition plan. Israel's partition plan would not have existed had it not been for the bribery, blackmail, and threats from the United States, countries that would not have allowed the partition plan to go through, did so.
So you're talking about 1948 here?
Yeah. I mean, well, 1947 was the partition plan, November 22nd. Israel declared statehood, so-called, in May 1948. But it was the blackmail and the threats from the United States that got Israel the partition plan. But so the question you need to ask yourself is why the United States would do that when the government, almost the entire government, was opposed to it. Only Harry Truman and the odious Clark Clifford, some new guy at the State Department who was a Zionist sock puppet. I have no idea if he was bribed or what, but he was responsible for overriding the resistance of General George Catlett Marshall, one of the greatest Americans who ever lived, who had integrity, something Clark Clifford did not have. Truman told Clifford that he was going to get a massive representation from Marshall and others against acknowledging Israel. Clifford was told to come up with a strong argument in favor of recognition. Harry Truman said he had 100,000 voices clamoring for Zionism in his constituency. He did not have 100,000 Arabs. Harry Truman was the greatest bastard president the United States has ever had. He dropped two bombs on Japan that were needless. And he allowed Israel to cheat international law and dispossess the Palestinians.
Well, it's an interesting conversation, this, because, you know, you're saying you didn't really want to get drawn into history, but this is absolutely key to understanding how the Israeli state got created. And I remember interviewing John Loftus many years ago. He explained to me in his book, The Secret War Against the Jews, he said, I didn't get a chance, I found this out afterwards, to put this in the book, but that Nelson Rockefeller, who was a part of the State Department in the late 1940s, he was a special representative of some sort for South America. He saw it as his job to deliver all the South American nations' votes at the newly formed United Nations for the partition of Palestine for the benefit of the Israelis. And he told Ben-Gurion that, you know, well, I could deliver you these votes, but you have to make a decision. You can have vengeance after the war on the Nazis, or you can have a state, a country, but not both. And so Ben-Gurion had to decide, well, look, I'm just going to drop all of the potential clamoring for vengeance against the Nazis, because the Americans want these Nazis involved in their it wasn't actually a CIA at that point, I think it was the OSS still, but the Americans wanted to bring all these former Nazis over and use them to build space rockets and God knows what else, and also of course to fight the Soviet Union.
That was Operation Paperclip. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why there was so little chasing of the Nazi war criminals, is because the Israelis have been told in no uncertain terms, well, you know, you can't do both. You can either go after the Nazis or you can have your own country, but not both.
I'll take you at face value on that. I wasn't aware of that, but it sounds quite plausible. There was a lot of dirty dealing between the Zionists, the Americans, and the Nazis. So it doesn't. It sounds perfectly believable, because in the United States there was a very strong, fascist movement. You see, fascism is a right, is extreme right wing. It has no philosophical foundation. It's simply an exploitative authoritarian belief system. It sets up a country, basically it's corporatist. And it supports private business, and it's virulently opposed to the Soviet Union or any sort of left-wing government. Now, this is what makes Americans really happy. And so a lot of the American politicians and some of the general public, too, I imagine, especially in business, saw Adolf Hitler as the lesser of two evils, or if not, someone to emulate. So there was probably very little reason in the United States to go after the Nazis, because there was a lot of, I know, good feeling in the United States for them.
Well, there'd also been George Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, had actually attempted a fascist coup just before World War II. But look, let's get back to now. And as a way of just rounding up, Greg, I wonder if you could say where you think this conflict is heading. Now we know that the Brits and the Americans this week have actually decided that their warships are going to actually attack countries on the side of this time it's the west side of the Red Sea. And these are the countries, of course, which have been being all sorts of problems over the last few years. Countries like Ethiopia, we've had disruption in there. We've had Sudan. We've had all sorts of rebels causing trouble there. And it now seems as if the British warships are on the side of these basically ISIS style rebels, people like the Boko Haram, these kinds of guys.
Well, it's very hard to see that the United Kingdom is having any independent foreign policy. I mean, it's rather sad to see the likes of Rishi Sunak being, he's essentially a stooge of British Petroleum. I mean, he only argued for a ceasefire once he realized that there was a problem getting oil through the around the Red Sea. The only reason Sunak is there is not for any political reason, but it's economic self-interest. He's a disgraceful little shit. And so you look at who and why the United States or the United Kingdom do anything, it's to serve Israel or to serve corporations. There's no real need to be there fighting the Yemenis, because the Yemenis are just, well, they don't pose a threat to anyone. They're just making life a little bit inconvenient. And businesses don't like to spend money they don't have to. So we end up with a scenario which is really quite distressing, where corporations are going to demand that the British and the American governments maintain a cheap flow of oil from the Middle East. And this is the reason that anybody does anything. I mean, we live in a very depressing time. We're living in a time where we are now devolving from a rational political world, at least the image of one, into a world that bears more of a resemblance to the dark ages of religious tyranny that obtained from about the 10th century to the 16th. We're living under a new religiosity, a new world where you're not allowed to challenge official narratives. You're not allowed to challenge power politics. It's a bit like the collapse of about Northern Italy, when the collapse of the Renaissance in the mid 16th century. I mean, there were wars that invasions by France and Spain contributed to the internal fissures between the nobility, the aristocracy, and the working class. people lived at this time had very little reason to hope. Life was extremely nasty, cruel, brutish, and short. And so we're living now in a world that is devolving into tyranny.
Well, you say religious, but the religion, is it a religion of petrodollars?
Well, I would say it's like the religion in the world today that dominates everybody's thinking to one degree or another, whether overtly or passively, is Holocaustianity. You can't criticize the official Zionist propaganda about World War II. And because you can't do that, Israel, which essentially dominates so much of the world, dictates national policy. Canada is, for example, is so afraid of the Israel lobby that the government would never stand in its way. It's all Trudeau can do, for example, is to say we won't, we'll abstain on a vote. That clearly requires a positive vote, and that abstention is proof that Canada is afraid to challenge the Israelis. The United States is afraid to challenge the Israelis. You watch the spokesman for Biden get up and answer questions. It's just embarrassing. Journalists are putting really good questions to him, and all he can do is mutter blithering nonsense about Hamas starting it, or that we're trying to ensure that civilians aren't harmed, or such things like this. I mean, it's embarrassing.
Okay, so where is this heading in Gaza? It's quite definitely and obviously a genocide, but is it going to end anytime soon? And if it doesn't, where is it heading?
I don't know. I'd like to think it does end soon, but you see, without an army, without an air force to coerce Israel into surrendering Gaza, I don't know how long this will go on. Israel has to be destroyed. It must be bombed into submission, or the Jews in Israel have to stage a revolution against the Zionist entity. There has to be a creation of a democratic state that incorporates Palestine and whatever Jews happen to be there, with compensation for the Jew, for the Arabs, as promised, as Israel promised in United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194, which formed the basis of its admission to the UN. And of course, Israel is an illegitimate member of the UN and needs to be expelled forthwith. And I brought this to the attention of a Irish MP, and I'm hoping it was received with thanks, and I'm hoping that something is mentioned in the dial of the Irish Parliament to get on record that Israel is an illegitimate member of the UN. But as far as goes, I don't know how long it'll go. I mean, I think that the Palestinians will win in the International Court of Justice, but because the United States is such a sycophantic stooge of Israel, it will sabotage any enforcement. This is why it's important to have a military. It's important to have the will to resort to force of arms to do something to defend your interests. And right now we have a lot of peace. The idea of people talking peace is disastrous. I mean, the one thing that the suffering in Palestine is doing is it's pointing out to the world that Israel was never legitimate to begin with, and that illegitimacy must be kept front and center. I don't know how long the world is going to have protest marches, how cities like Barcelona, Berlin, Paris, London, New York. These are countries that have had huge public demonstrations of support for Palestine. I hope we can keep this up, but I hope fatigue does not set in, which I think is what Israel is counting on. They're prepared to put up with abuse and attacks because of their genocide, but they know eventually people will tire and they will forget, and it will be back to murder as usual. I just hope that doesn't happen. And
Greg, whereabouts can people get hold of your books? Can you just run through them, please?
Sure. My book, The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America, as well as my other book, Exploding Middle East Myths, is available from moneytreepublishing.com. My book on the SARS virus, SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, which proved the synthetic origin of the SARS-2 virus, is available from turningthetidepublishing.com.
Okay, so, Greg Felton, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Tony. Hope to be on your show again soon.